Mr. Dabowski.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Augusta Edwards. There's a certain irony in this case in that Briggs & Stratton, the defendant appellee, was the beneficiary of substantial compliance in one of the seminal decisions issued by this circuit in relation to that doctrine. Yet when the shoe was on the other foot, Briggs & Stratton resisted the plaintiff's efforts to obtain the same consideration and that substantial compliance be given to her modestly tardy appeal that was submitted to the Briggs & Stratton pension plan. This court made it very clear, though, in Davis versus Combs, that the substantial compliance doctrine is not just one that's applicable and can benefit the plan administrator. The substantial compliance doctrine can also benefit the plan participant. The court made it very clear, and they said, and I quote, minor inadvertence on the employee's part should lead to a parallel result. Related to the doctrine of substantial compliance, there's also the issue of the notice prejudice rule effect here. At no point in the record before this court is there any indication that Briggs & Stratton suffered any prejudice whatsoever by virtue of the 11-day delay in the submission of the claim appeal. No argument has been made, no facts have been put forth before this court that suggest that there was any prejudice or harm suffered by the plan in not accepting Ms. Edwards' appeal. And while it is...
Let's assume for the moment that the notice prejudice statute applies to this plan. What did you show in the record that it wasn't reasonably possible to provide that appeal within the prescribed time?
We didn't, but that's not part of the notice prejudice equation. In the Unum versus Ward, first of all, let me just take one step back.
Yeah, and I guess I can't figure out why you didn't meet the deadline. I just don't see anything that shows, the Dr. Stoll's report is September of the relevant year, and the VE's report is March 27th, and there's no indication, and it's based primarily, it's a page and a half or so based primarily on Dr. Stoll's report. Why that couldn't have been done well within the time frame.
Your Honor, we're not making an excuse. We're standing before the court. We're saying mea culpa. We're asking for some minor consideration here.
I feel like you're asking us to rewrite ERISA and the plan because of attorney negligence.
Not at all. Not at all. In the first place, the doctrine of substantial compliance has been adopted by this court as a matter of federal common law. The notice prejudice rule has also been accepted by the United States Supreme Court as a matter of federal common law. The notice prejudice rule does not look at whether the claimant had a reasonable excuse or any excuse. The question is that late notice may be forgiven so long as the plan has not experienced any prejudice.
What about the language in the statute that says that if the insured shows it was not reasonably possible to give notice within the prescribed time and that notice was given as soon as reasonably possible? Isn't that in the statute?
No.
Oh, okay. So I'm reading a different statute.
I think you may be looking at the regulations, but there is nothing explicit in the ERISA statute here.
But we're in the notice of prejudice statute.
The notice prejudice statute is applicable to insurance in Wisconsin. We were just using that to advise the court and instruct the court that Wisconsin recognizes the doctrine inherent in the notice prejudice rule. Illinois does not. Illinois has explicitly rejected it, but this case arose in Wisconsin. And consistent both with the statutory law and the common law of the state of Wisconsin, the notice prejudice rule can be adopted within the common law of ERISA.
Surely you don't want us to have different ERISA law in Illinois and Wisconsin.
No.
It needs to be uniform, national rule.
Given the policy considerations that are set forth in the Unum versus Ward case, as a matter of federal common law that would be applicable throughout the Seventh Circuit, The notice prejudice rule is entirely consistent with the dictum in the Ward case that says that allowing late appeals, allowing appeals beyond the minimum dates set forth in the ERISA regulation, and I quote, complements rather than contradicts ERISA and the regulations. So this would be entirely consistent with the ERISA law, consistent with Unum versus Ward, consistent with this court's decision in Davis versus Combs, to permit this modest delay in submitting the claim appeal.
In this case, you had 180 days, right?
Correct.
And at least the way I understand this, the standard of review here is whether it was arbitrary and capricious for the plan to refuse to entertain the appeal on the merits. If that's correct, at what point would it become, if we were to agree with you, at what point would the plan be entitled to enforce a deadline?
The cases that the plan cites are cases that are so distinct from this case as to be essentially irrelevant. The Gallegos case, which the plan cited,
could you answer my question? At what point would it be, would a plan be entitled to enforce a deadline for an appeal?
I think that point would be whatever is reasonable under the circumstances. A 30-day...
Doesn't that put a plan in an impossible situation where it's subject to fiduciary review, it has fiduciary duties subject to judicial review, and it could never with confidence enforce a deadline, could it?
If there had been no notice given that an appeal was forthcoming, I could possibly see the plan's position that the appeal was 11 days late.
But you talk about reasonable under the circumstances. If they have no circumstances whatsoever here other than that it's late, you give no reason why you couldn't get it within the 180 days or within a day later or what have you.
And the reason is that the vocational expert's report was delayed, but that was not something within the plan's control.
Delayed? It's dated March 27th.
March 28th, I believe, but it was sent to my co-counsel in Wisconsin, then it was sent to me. We had that appeal ready and submitted as fast as we got it. But in all candor with the court, obviously 180 days is a reasonable period of time.
Do we know when that VE report was ordered?
That doesn't appear in the record. It was certainly requested much earlier than March 28th. But I became involved in the case in February, approximately the time that Mr. Bush sent the letter to the plan. Just one last point, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. And that is the fact that the decision that was made by the plan in this case was based on an extremely selective review of the evidence, that the party who's going to suffer here is Ms. Edwards. If this somewhat tardy late appeal is rejected. The statute was enacted for Ms. Edwards' protection, and given the shoddy way in which the plan considered her claim, the only fair resolution would be to allow and permit the late appeal under the doctrines of substantial compliance and or under the doctrine of notice prejudice. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Wilson from Quarles & Brady, and I represent the Briggs & Statton Retirement Plan. I'd like to start out by addressing one assertion that Mr. Dubofsky made during his presentation, and that is that there is some federal common law notice prejudice rule. To my understanding, that is not the case. The Supreme Court in the Unum decision examined the effect of the California notice prejudice rule, which is quite different than Wisconsin's notice prejudice rule in several respects. Importantly, the California notice prejudice rule would require an insurer to establish that it was prejudiced by a delay. Under the Wisconsin law, the burden of proof is on the claimant to establish that the insurer did not suffer prejudice. Since the Supreme Court in the Unum decision was examining the California law, it stands right that in this case the applicable notice prejudice rule, to the extent it applies in this situation at all, ought to be Wisconsin's. The relief that Ms. Edwards requests in this case would reduce the deadlines in ERISA cases to mere guidelines. As the court has recognized during Mr. Dubofsky's presentation, that's an untenable position for plan administrators to be in. Edwards has conceded.
Well, how about the cases that, for example, we allow plans to say, well, this was just a Scrivener's error, right? And don't we allow plans to miss deadlines?
Your Honor, as an initial matter, no decisions have allowed a claimant to miss a deadline under the doctrine of substantial compliance. It is true that this Court has addressed issues such as Scrivener's errors with regard to claims denials, and in particular often with regard to the technical requirements of how a plan goes about denying a claim. In situations in which the courts have addressed whether a plan has substantially complied with timing requirements in connection with deciding appeals, the discussion is whether the plan has waived its right to arbitrary and capricious review of its decision. If it has substantially complied with the deadline, then the plan's decision will still be entitled to the very deferential arbitrary and capricious review, whereas if it has not substantially complied with the deadline, the decision will be subject to de novo review. When it's a claimant that's missed a deadline, that discussion doesn't make sense.
Was that fair?
Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
That we indulge plans mistakes, but not claimants?
That is what the decisions have told us thus far.
Which decisions are you relying on to enforce strict compliance against the claimant?
I'm sorry.
Which decisions are you relying upon to enforce strict compliance against the claimants?
To enforce strict compliance? Well, I would point to the fact that there are no decisions allowing a claimant to miss a deadline and have that be excused under the doctrine of substantial compliance. We've cited in our brief decisions that have held that a claimant has failed to exhaust his or her administrative remedies by missing a deadline. And those cases don't indicate that a brief delay in filing an appeal is okay or acceptable, but that some lengthy delay is unacceptable.
Well, would you agree with me that the penalty of refusing to consider an appeal is a more stringent penalty imposed on claimants for missing a deadline than the switch from deferential review to de novo review is when a plan misses a deadline?
I would agree with that statement under the current state of the law, yes.
And why should that be the law? Obviously the statutory language doesn't answer that question, does it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The statutory language doesn't answer that question, does it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm slightly hard of hearing.
Does the statutory language answer that question?
The statutory language does say, as this Court held in the Wagner decision last summer, that plans are required to consistently enforce the terms, their
well,
terms.
Well, you would not say here that you were required to reject her appeal, would you?
No.
You had the discretion to allow the late appeal.
Your Honor, certainly the plan could, in an individual case, in its discretion, allow an appeal.
Okay, so you don't have to be strict in your compliance with the plan.
There's no requirement in the law that there's 180 days, but there is a requirement in the plan that claims be filed within 180 days, and this Court has said in decisions such as the Wagner decision last summer that plans are required to consistently apply the rules and
but
that.
You just told me that you could have decided to allow this late appeal. Did I misunderstand that?
Your Honor, what the plan could have done, it would have been inconsistent with the plan's the terms of the plan to accept a late appeal.
That's not my question. I thought you told me a moment ago that the plan could have, that the plan administrator had the discretion to allow a late appeal?
In theory, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's suppose you're in Louisiana in the weeks after Hurricane Katrina, and the appeal is late. Surely a plan in that situation could exercise its discretion to entertain a late appeal, right?
Well, that would certainly be a different case than the case before the court, since there at least would be some justification.
That's
in that
not
case.
My question. Okay. The question is, do you have discretion to allow late appeals?
My answer, Your Honor, is that in theory the plan could do that, but that would be inconsistent with the terms of the plan provisions.
I'll take that as a yes. Is that a fair understanding of your answer?
Your Honor, my answer is that it would
are
be
are you telling me the plan would never excuse a late appeal?
To my knowledge, Your Honor, the plan does not accept late appeals.
Has this ever come up before?
I honestly don't know, Your Honor. The appellant has made no legitimate argument as to why the appeal deadline was missed. The appellant conceded in its summary judgment briefing in the district court that it may be true that the appeal could have been filed within the deadline. As the court pointed out, the doctor's report, which is one of the two documents upon which the appeal was based, was received or was generated more than 5 months before the appeal deadline. And the vocational report was generated or was dated 4 days before the deadline. Now, while it might have been tight to work that report into an appeal that would be timely, certainly is possible. Thus, there's no basis upon which to overturn the district court's finding that Edwards had an obligation to exhaust her administrative remedies and failed to do so. The appellant argues in her reply brief, and again today, that plan administrators have a duty to protect plan beneficiaries and participants. In fact, that's one of the linchpins of the appellant's argument. We certainly agree with that, and that's precisely why the federal regulations require a full and fair review of claims. But the federal regulations also discuss how far a plan administrator has to go in providing a full and fair review. And they state that a reasonable limit is 180 days. That, of course, is consistent with the deadline that was imposed in this case. The appellant also relies heavily on language in the opinion below regarding the deference owed to plan administrators under ERISA. I think it's important to put the language in the court's opinion into context. It's clear from the decision that the judge is referring to the deference owed to plan administrators under the arbitrary and capricious standard and was not saying, as Ms. Edwards has argued, that the judge thought the plan didn't have an obligation to protect the interests of beneficiaries. That is made clear by the context of the decision. In fact, the sentence that precedes the language quoted repeatedly by Ms. Edwards says, quote, what Edwards seeks the court to do here is to intervene and substitute its judgment for that of the plan. And then follows the sentence quoted by Ms. Edwards, and as such action would be inconsistent with the policy of deference to plan administrators that underlies ERISA. That by putting that language into context, it's pretty clear that the court was saying that was demonstrated that it understands how the arbitrary and capricious standard works, not that it owes some abject deference to plan administrators. Unless there are further questions from the bench, I will sit down.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dubofsky.
There were no cases cited by the defendant appellee that raised situations comparable to this case. The Gallegos case involved a delay of a year before notice of appeal was given. The Swanson case, although notice was given within 180 days, the appeal was submitted 3 years later. Hardly anything close to the substantial compliance that we're seeking before this court. Yet we cited to this court several district court cases, including the Oman case, the Ratehouse case, where delays of 10 days, 13 days, were forgiven by the courts and considered to be within the doctrine of substantial compliance. The Wagner case, besides being non-precedential, is wholly irrelevant. In the Wagner case, an effort was made to reappeal after the appeal was already exhausted. That's not the situation here. The situation here is that the plaintiff had a meritorious appeal. The court has seen the appeal letter that we submitted. It's lengthy. It runs from pages 11 through 18 of the record. It covers a number of issues. Obviously, it took a tremendous amount of time to prepare that letter to deal with the issues as comprehensively as we did. A delay of 11 days is hardly egregious. It may be considered negligible tardiness, but that's the worst.
What's the rule we should apply from your perspective?
The rule that the court should apply is a rule that gives the benefit of substantial compliance to claimants as well as to plan administrators.
As applied to a deadline, what does that sound like?
Unfortunately, there has to be a degree of flexibility depending on the circumstances.
So there's no deadline?
Certainly something within 30 days would, by any measure, be deemed substantial compliance.
But of course, you just gave the answer. The circumstances. Had there been a submission, said, "Look, we didn't get to do this because I was ill. I wasn't in my office. Any of those things." But that wasn't given. So there are no circumstances. It's just late.
It's late.
That's it.
As the courts forgive the plans, the courts should forgive the claimants who the statute was enacted to benefit. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take this case under advisement.